Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. Michael Steele with you to have another great conversation. So glad you could drop in for a moment to really engage in what I think you and I hope you will find to be an interesting and important conversation with a gentleman who is a part of American history. Some may say that's not, you know, that's not necessarily a good thing when you know the backstory, but it's important history. And it is good in the sense that we get now to understand better and see with greater clarity through the eyes of then a young child and now a grown man, how our criminal justice system, how our policing system, and how our society works, particularly when it comes to young men of color. My guest and I, we were just talking a little bit ago, just really excited and honored to be a part and connected to his history, Yousef Salaam. He's not just an inspirational speaker, but he's a prison abolitionist who, at the age of 14, was one of the five teenage boys wrongly convicted and sentenced to prison in the Central Park jogger case. In 1997, he left prison as an adult to a world he didn't fully recognize nor understand. And in 2002, the sentences for the Central Park Five were overturned and all five were exonerated for the crime they did not commit. Today, Yousef travels the world as an inspirational leader, speaking about the effects of incarceration and the devastating impact of disenfranchisement. He is an advocate and an educator on issues of mass incarceration, police brutality and misconduct, press ethics and bias, race and law, and the disparities in our system that impact those most vulnerable, particularly men of color. His new memoir, Better, Not Bitter, Living on Purpose in the Pursuit of Racial Justice, is out now. And I am excited to have this conversation with Yousef Salaam. Welcome, brother.
Oh, man. Listen, it's a pleasure to be here with you. Definitely an honor. And I'm excited about this time we have.
Well, I'm excited. I'm excited about you not shrinking away, not to say that there isn't any post-traumatic distress from what you went through. But a lot of times that can be crippling, particularly for a young man. The bitterness sets in, which is why I love that title, Better Not Bitter. Walk us through, just so we can get up to speed, to that moment. And you capture it in the introduction in a way that I think kind of speaks to what you as a young 16-year-old standing there with Antoine McCray, Kevin Richardson, Raymond Santana, Corey Wise, waiting for this verdict that you thought, as you said, I'd be home tonight with my mama. This will all be over. And then the hammer comes down, guilty. What is that moment like when you know as a young man, I didn't do this?
Yeah.
What more can I say? How do I use my voice better? Who can I get help from to let them know I did not do this?
You know, the worst part about it is that you're at the gate, right? You're at the seat of all power, all authority, all of the justice in America. And here you are being wakened up to what in many ways is called the American nightmare. And that American nightmare, it quickly described in a very traumatic way the lives of 14, 15, and 16-year-olds, right?
Mm-hmm.
Children at the time that were vilified with over 400 articles being written about them. Not a single person sat down with any one of us or our families and asked us any questions about our lives. They broad brushstroked this narrative that continued to seize on the fears of the public. And in many ways, I want to really be honest, right? I thought that this was a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that we had, this was the worst of it, right? We had been awakened to a nightmare and we will be able to finally really wake up. And at that moment when the gavel came down, after the words guilty began to be echoed throughout that courtroom, it was the worst feeling in the world. The air was quickly sucked out of the room.
Right.
I don't know how I stood or how any one of us continued to stand. Our knees buckled, you know. We didn't get the opportunity in some cases, as you may see, and we've seen through the criminal justice system, where people get an opportunity to, you know, go home and prepare.
Right, right.
Listen, they'd be told, listen, we'll have sentencing. And in our case, we were sentenced on the 11th of September. And we were held, we were handcuffed, led to the back, and
processed
until right. We came before the judge again to be sentenced. And it was the most horrible thing, you know. But it taught me a lesson, right? My mother had always been telling me that she was raised in the Jim Crow South.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't reconcile what that meant because, of course, we were in New York.
Right.
The experiences that we were experiencing, although there were terrible things that were happening, it wasn't in mass, at least. It didn't feel that way. It wasn't as if we had social media that was telling us what this was. And here we now have social media, and we understand that cases like ours, Central Park Jogger case, is not an anomaly.
No, it's not. And we've seen that. And just reset for us how the police approached you and Anton and Kevin and Raymond, Corey.
So
how did they get to you guys? this was a white woman jogging in Central Park.
Yes.
Basically, that's all the premise you need, because every black person in America knows what happens next, right?
I mean, the worst part about it is that we saw a recent example where, you know, this young man was in Central Park. This white woman called the police on him. And thank God he had his camera on, right? And for me, it really caused me to understand this reality that we experience, right, in America, right? This reality that says that to be African-American, as Dr. James Baldwin said, is to be African without memory. But more importantly, it's to be American without privilege,
mm-hmm.
right? The duality, yeah. If you have some semblance of consciousness or understanding of what's going on, causes you to be in a state of rage all the time. But you still have to put on your happy face. You still have to go outside and make things happen, live your life, if you will. And so in this particular case, Raymond Santana and a lot of folks, I want to remind people, right? This woman was victimized mm-hmm. in the absolute worst way that you could imagine.
Right.
And
right.
She was left for dead. So if you look at the scene, this is a gruesome scene. This is a heinous act. And the crime should be solved and solved quickly. The police officers arrest immediately Kevin Richardson and Raymond Santana. They were arrested the night of April 19th, 1989. I'm saying that because if they had anything to do with this crime, they would have had evidence on them. There would have been DNA. There would have been, you know, they convinced the public that Kevin Richardson struggled with the jogger and she scratched him. That's how he got that mark on his face. And it wasn't until you heard it from his own mouth, and then even still more recent times when They See Us accurately portrayed what happened, that you quickly understood why was there no DNA evidence in this case. It's because the public was lied to, she was lied to, and this lie continues to gain momentum. Even though the truth came out. The truth came out in 2002, 13 years after we were accused of the crime. But the damage was already done. And so here it is. We look at that night, folks are getting arrested. We look at the night right after that. Myself and Corey Wise, who's not even a suspect, we get arrested. And I say we get arrested because he was tricked. He was asked if he wanted to go downtown with his buddy. He'd be right back. He comes home 13 years later. None of us know what Miranda is. None of us are being told what our rights are. We haven't, even now, today, we don't learn civics. Civics will give us a great opportunity to know that we have rights, but more importantly, how to use the rights, right? A lot of people nowadays, even children who happen to be children of law enforcement, if they look like me and they say, I know my rights, the officers oftentimes, if they're bad cops, and not all of them are, right? The great majority of cops are not bad. But what happens in these cases where we see these egregious acts continue to be perpetuated against us as a people is that they say one of those. They turn the cameras off, and then they begin to instill the nightmare. They wake people up to that nightmare.
How did they get to you five? Okay, so they've got two young men out of the gate. So you said it was Antron and Kevin out of the gate. So they get those two. How does Raymond, Corey, and Yusef get wrapped up and pulled into this narrative because of their friendship association with the other two?
It's actually a lot simpler than that. And I say that because we as lay people, you know, we are pseudo experts. We watch TV shows like NCIS, CSI.
Right, right. You know, Law and Order.
We know how the system works. Right. And so we know things, right? And what's interesting about the Central Park Jogger case in particular is that the public was made to believe that we all knew each other, that we were all friends, that we all said, hey, listen, at 9 o'clock, remember, we're going to go out wilding. Right. That's not even how we talked, first of all. Right.
Right. Right.
They took the word and they gave it a definition. The word was wildin'. Right. It's just the way people utilize language. Yeah. And cool. Right. We hang out
like wilding out. Right. Exactly.
Wilding out. Right. Right. And the worst part
having
about
a good time.
As I look at this case now with new eyes, with the eyes of understanding what the system is, I know clearly that people were trying to save their own lives. Questions were being asked. Who was in the park with you? Oh, I think it was this. I saw this tall guy. Mind you, I was over 6 feet tall since I was 12 years old. I'm in Central Park. The photo on the book is, this is my mugshot. This is my side profile. When they tell you to turn to the side.
Right.
So I'm over 6 feet tall. I have a flat top. I have designs cut in my hair. This is an upside down crown. In my hair, cut in designs. And of course, when they say who was in the park, what did they look like, you get an opportunity that's very rare that I ever show people this. I just got this back from my attorneys a little while ago.
Wow.
These were the pants that I was wearing.
Wow.
I was wearing these pants and a sky blue jacket to match on April 19th, 1989. And as you can see, there's artwork all over my pants.
Yeah.
There's no blood on it. These were the pants. They took these pants. They went over it with a fine-tooth comb because they believed the narrative that they had created for themselves. And so who was in the park? I don't know. Well, what did they look like? We know this because we watch TV, right?
I'm
saying, even if they say, well, there was a tall guy. Tall guy. Okay. Then they start going to the surrounding areas. Hey, who's tall in this area? What? My nickname was Kane because people said I looked like Big Daddy Kane back then. And I rapped, right?
Right.
And so they were like, oh, that's Kane. Kane? Okay, who's Kane? So one thing leads to another. And I'm saying this because we've seen TV shows that replicate the narrative and we understand what happens as a result of that. And so they come to us, and mind you, I heard that the police were looking for me. In my naivety, in my youthfulness of understanding what this system is, I said, I'm going to go to the cops and tell them what I know, and I'll be home before my mom gets back.
Yeah.
And I'm saying that because were there things that happened in Central Park that were awful? Yes. Were there things that I saw that were awful? Yes. We never deny being in the park. But the people who were victimized over and above the Central Park jogger, we understand why she couldn't identify anybody in the court of law because they said she had amnesia.
Right.
But the other individuals that were victimized picked people out of lineups. They said that was the one who did this to me, or these people did this to me.
Mm-hmm.
When they came to the courthouse, this is part of the court record. When they came to the courthouse on the witness stand and were asked, do you see the person or persons who did this? They looked around and said it wasn't any of these guys. The people who assaulted the individuals in Central Park never became known as the Central Park Five. Remember, when this case first happened, we were called the Central Park Seven.
Mm-hmm.
And then Michael Briscoe, with his brilliant attorney, Alton Maddox, was able to get out of this case. Then it was the Central Park Six. And then what happens? Three of us go to trial and lose first, myself, Raymond Santana, and Antron. And we lose, and they go back to Kevin, Corey, and Stephen Lopez at the time. And they say, listen, y'all gonna lose just like they did. Stephen Lopez, now mind you, they were telling us we are facing 3 1/3 to 10 years for each of the major charges that we were charged with.
Right.
I think I got convicted with 3 of the major charges. So it looked like I was facing 3, 6, 9 at least years.
Yeah, 9 to 30 years.
To 30 years, right? Yeah. This is what they were saying. They're gonna charge us as adults. So of course, Stephen Lopez says, I'm not gonna, what? Listen, let me see if I could cop out to a crime that I didn't even do. He cops out to robbing someone. He didn't even rob the person. And he does 1 to 3 years and comes home very shortly thereafter. Then there's the two that's left, Corey and Kevin, and they lose. Now we become known as the Central Park Five. That moniker stuck for years. And it wasn't until 2014, really before that, 2012, I would say, when the book was written, The Central Park Five, A Chronicle of a City Wilding, that we got an understanding of what this was about. Natalie Byfield writes a book on the heels of that, because that was Sarah Byrne's book. She writes a book called Savage Portrayals. She was a former reporter for the Daily News, and she was able to pull out all of the headlines and create a book masterfully done that showed how they were using language in order to seize on the fears of the public, how they were creating the monster that Walter Dean Myers.
They needed the boogeyman.
And
in this case, and one of the aspects that you see in a lot of these police dramas, you know, it's like, well, the mayor's, you know, having a fit, you know, we got to solve this case. And you kind of get the sense that while that may be a dramatization in some sense, it really isn't in another, in that the societal pressures, the media pressures, the political pressures that come into play force the criminal justice system to find a solution, to find someone that they can say, you did it, we're done.
They have to do that. And I'm looking for my other book only because I wanna share something that we all know, right? And we know this only because we look at the system and we almost think and feel that the system is these compartments. But when we look at the umbrella that created the system, the Constitution of the United States, we read, we the people.
Right.
And if we pause right there and we do a deep dive in history, what we find out is that black and brown people were not considered whole human beings. We were considered 3/5 of a person. And then we go further and we understand, okay, they have this thing called the 13th Amendment. And in that amendment, I'm not even going to read the whole thing. I just want to read Section 2. This is in my book, Punching the Air. Section 2, Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. Now, in Section 1, it uses the word very specifically slavery, and then it also uses the word involuntary servitude.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to point out that word slavery in particular, because slavery is abolished. But the only way slavery continues in America is through the criminal justice system, which is oftentimes called the criminal legal system. And in that legal system, just as we saw, Congress is creating laws that will allow for people to be pushed back into that state. And then you go as a person who's been on the inside coming out. I can tell you and describe to you, this is where our grandfathers have been disappeared to. Mm-hmm. Our fathers, our brothers, our cousins, uncles, this is where we have been disappeared to. The overwhelming majority in the prison industrial complex are black and brown bodies.
That's right.
And so when I think about the need for there to be sweeping changes, right? And I don't even want to say sweeping change. I want to say transformative changes.
Right.
In the language of today, there's been conversations thrown around about defunding the police, about abolition and so forth and so on. And I think the worst part is that the people who have been at the brunt of it, right? The people who have received the worst of it have not been able to define what that means. But the definition has been given to us by the same system that has created this situation.
Ain't that something?
So what we think when we hear words like abolition, oh my right. goodness, how can we live in a state of lawlessness? Right. That's not what's being stated.
Right.
I mean, think about what the most brilliant minds have said. We as a people, if we've never been run over by the spike wheels of justice, we know someone who has.
That's right.
We know about the history of slavery in America. We just revisited the Tulsa massacre, right? Right. And I'm saying all of this to say that it is amazing that we are still resilient enough to not want revenge. We've only wanted equality.
Right.
We only wanted legislation that allowed for there to be true justice, true liberty, true equality on these shores, because all of us didn't immigrate here. The transatlantic slave trade teaches us that that is not true. But the idea that we all immigrated here, the idea that we voluntarily built this country, the idea of all of this, I'm saying that out of that, without any assistance, Black Wall Streets happened. And I'm saying streets. I'm not saying street, right?
Because yeah. There's always more than one. There's always been more than one.
Because we have to be able to look at this with a 30,000 foot view to understand these instances of oppression are connected. But how do we become better and not bitter? Because the system will make you into a bitter person because you don't want that apology.
That's a very powerful point, because Kimberly Jones, who I love her, and you're probably familiar with her and her viral video from a year or so ago, where she laid out the indictment against the very system you're talking about. And in it, at the end of it, She kind of looked at the camera and she goes, you know, basically, white folks need to be glad that we're just seeking equality and not revenge.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of truth to that, particularly when you consider, and I love the way you describe the system, you know, and the words in those founding documents and how, you know, they're written, they still underscore a reality and a truth for Black America, Black and Brown America, that we're still 3/5 of a person.
And we're still seeing it. And when you say we're still, what is most amazing in that statement is that when we're looking at things, right, we see instances of grandmothers being pulled out of their car by their hair.
Mm-hmm.
We see instances of families being told to get on the ground, mother, father, and children, the babies too. Mm-hmm. Everybody kiss the ground, right? We see these things and we feel like in today's reality, the kaleidoscope of the human family is the people. The problem is that we've never went back to revisit and reform and fix this idea that is not broken, right? And so systemically, we're looking at police officers and in their origin stories, yes, there are excellent cops out there. I met a few, right? I personally met a few.
Mm-hmm.
Young lady stood up in the audience in 2013, I believe it was, told me she was 13 years old, that she was a cadet, and that she wanted to become a cop. And she asked me, what advice could I give her? Now, initially, I wanted her to run.
Right.
But then the most beautiful thing happened. I realized that I was talking to the future. In what has been called Afrofuturism, we get the opportunity to dream with our eyes wide open. And so I'm telling this young lady about what Dr. King said. And what he said was, when you find your purpose in life, do it as if God himself called you to do it at this very moment.
That's it. Amen.
And so if you look at it from that perspective, here's a young person whose energy is vibrating at such a high level that she's saying, I know what I want to do. How beautiful is that? We want our children to be able to figure that out. And she wants to become a cop. And so I told her that in my travels in America, on the side of every cop car, in some variation, are the words to serve and protect. How noble a thing is that? I summed up everything I said to her by saying to her, the ultimate advice that I want to give to you is that I want you to do your job. Because if you do your job, you will be the best.
That's right.
You'll be the shining example. And this is what we need, right?
Well,
we
need
a system that gives us the opportunity to, in America, the youngest nation in the world, a place where immigrants have come from and settled down, who have their own police officers and criminal justice systems. Michael Moore gave us examples as he created his film and showed it to the world, Where to Invade Next. We at least know that as a young superpower, we can restore our name in the world by doing the best for its citizens, all of them.
You in the intro sum up literally in the first paragraph the feeling and the emotion behind Better Not Bitter. And you say, quote, they didn't know who they had. I say this often, and most people think it is something I figured out, you know, after being imprisoned for a crime I did not commit. It is not. From very early on, I innately knew that I had a destiny that existed beyond the one the criminal justice system attempted to assign me. I just needed to live long enough for that purpose to come to fruition. And to be honest, my survival wasn't the only thing at stake. My physical survival, yes, but also my mental and emotional endurance. They didn't know who they had. What I love about that, and I think what that speaks to for me, is in the midst of all of that, you still found, as you're standing there as a 16-year-old kid, found guilty of a crime you did not commit, you still saw hope.
Yeah.
You still saw that in sort of a weird, and I don't want to put words in your words there, but in a weird kind of way, you still thought the system would work and that you would be found not guilty of this crime. This right. moment, yes, painful, hurtful for the five of us, the bullshit that's involved in the criminal justice system to just find some black kids and put them out there and everybody will go sleep tonight. You still had hope in this system that it would self-correct and do the right thing. How do you channel pain into something positive? How do you find not only the capacity to hope, but to rebuild yourself in a way that is the guiding principle, the guiding light?
You know, I think that what we often see as awful experiences, we don't always see the grace, the opportunity. And I'm saying that because, you know, many people heard about the story of Jonah and the whale, right? When you look at it from a different angle, you see that this is an opportunity because he lived after that, right? His life was restored. His family was restored. Everything that was taken from him was given back 100 times more than what was taken. And I'm using his example in particular because when we realize that there's grace and opportunity, we realize that life is trying to create us all and make us diamonds, all of us. How do you make a diamond? A diamond is created out of coal. And you can't make a diamond out of raw coal. That coal has to have tremendous amounts of pressure placed upon it.
Mm-hmm.
And then more pressure still. Everyone wants the success of what the diamond is, but the process of going through allows you to be able to understand once you become the diamond that you can choose to go through something or you can choose to grow through something. I had the opportunity very early on to remember the words of my mother. And what she said to me when she got me out of the interrogation room for a moment, she said, first, stop talking to them. And second, she said, they need you to participate in whatever it is that they're trying to do. Do not participate. Refuse. Now I'm telling every one of us to be able to step back, do a 30,000 foot view of this to understand that was she talking about my situation at that moment? Yes, she was. Can that same instruction be applied to life and everything that we go through? Absolutely. And the reason why it can is because if we step back into sacred memory and we remember just one thing, that when our mother and father got together, regardless of how we were created, when our mother and father got together, each of us were one of over 400 million options. We are all walking miracles.
Yeah.
We were all born on purpose. And if we were born on purpose, then that means that we have a purpose. The problem is this. In the margins of society, oftentimes in the Black and Brown communities, we are being told through technology that you are not worth nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And through technology, we've accepted a narrative. That narrative says that you're going to be dead or in jail before you reach the age of 21. I'm saying that if we reject that narrative, if we know that we were born on purpose and with a purpose, why are we allowing a system to give us a definition of life that stops our life at most 21, right?
Mm-hmm.
We all have the opportunity to choose not just what happens. We can't choose what happens to us. That's one of the basic truths. But we can choose what happens inside of us as our response. And so I looked at the Central Park Jogger case, and I talk about this in my book. And I said, you know what? This is amazing. The Central Park Jogger case is actually a love story between God and his people. Could I see it when I was going through it? No. But after I grew through it, I said the Central Park Jogger case is a love story between God and his people. It's a story of a criminal system of injustice turned on its side and placed on trial in order to produce a miracle in modern time. It's a story of how a people can be brought low only to rise because the truth can never stay buried. Mm-hmm. It's a story of a people buried alive and forgotten. The system forgot that we were seeds. And instead of a social death, we've emerged like the phoenix from the ashes. Because as they built the fire to consume us, we forgot the owner of the heat. Now, what am I talking about here? I'm talking about faith. I'm talking about mustard seed faith. I'm not talking about big faith.
Right, right.
I'm talking about creating a vision board and starting a process where you begin to say, you know what? I want a lucky life. So how do you have a lucky life? You realize that luck is an acronym that stands for laboring under correct knowledge. You can't take a shortcut. If you do the right thing at the right time, then you have to know that the result is that you will get success.
Right.
But you have to do the work. Just like fear is an acronym that stands for false evidence appearing real. We are so fearful of our own greatness even that we put our hopes and dreams on an island called someday. And as I've heard the greatest of the greats say it, they said the wealthiest place in the world is not in Saudi Arabia where there's oil or Africa where there's gold and diamonds. It is the graveyard where people's hopes, dreams, and aspirations have been placed on a someday that never came.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of their life, they were never able to give the world that specialness that only they could give. And I talk about the great philosopher Cardi B in my book, where she says, knock me down 9 times, I'll get up 10.
Right.
It's because I want us all to understand that even though I'm talking about the Central Park jogger case, even though I'm talking about myself in the context of the Central Park jogger case, I am also talking about the black and brown experience in America.
Because that, regardless of whether you were standing in that courtroom with those 5 young boys or not, yeah, you're still there. You know, and in some way, we're all connected into that because we're part of the system.
Yeah.
And at any moment, it's something I tell my sons, you know, who are grown men and they're living their lives in the world. But I still have to remind them, you still have to deal with a system that sees you differently than they see your white friends, that will approach you differently, treat you differently than they see and treat your white compatriots. And you have to, it's unfortunate, but you've got to be hip to that. You have to understand it in order to move through it. Because like your mama said to you, you know, don't work with them in putting that noose around your neck and putting those handcuffs on your hands and bounding your feet. Don't work with them. You have to. And that's what I love about this story and the way you share it is you make it very clear that the young man that they had in that courtroom and the grown man that's standing here today are in fact the same person. Right. And while the struggle was tough on the young man, the grown man, the adult, is wiser, stronger, better from it, and is anchored in that hope such that he knows he is better because he's not bitter. Absolutely. He knows he, and that in the end of it, Youssef, when you stop and think about it, when you look at the chattel system, you look at the slavery system, you look at the sharecropper system, you look at the Jim Crow era, it's all about breaking the spirit.
Yes.
And that's exactly what we see happening today with 47 states trying to change voting laws in this country, because Black folks showed up and voted in 2020 in unprecedented numbers. And for the first time in generations actually engaged in the system, what is the response? Okay, now we're going to break their will.
Yeah.
We want to break that spirit, because we cannot let that spirit prevail and stand against us.
Yeah.
And that's what you represent in so many ways, is the prevailing of the spirit against the odds. And despite a system that bore down on you to break you, you actually wind up breaking it. And that's what I hope people get from reading Better, Not Bitter. I want to take a quick break because I want to come back and talk a little politics with you. You seem like a brother, may have a view on some politics. So we're going to take a quick break. We're having, this is just for me, a mesmerizing moment to have this conversation with Youssef Salaam. And I'm so glad all of you could be a part of this conversation with me. Give us a few. We'll be right back right after this.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Welcome back, everybody. We're having a conversation with Youssef Salaam. You know him. Understand his story as a member of the Central Park Five, wrongly convicted in 1989 for a crime he did not commit. Has now come out with a story, a memoir of that journey and his experience. It's Better, Not Bitter, Living on Purpose in the Pursuit of Racial Justice. So, Youssef, I don't like to talk about the former guy that much anymore, because that just opens up a crap hole of crazy that you don't want to have to dwell in. But there is, you do have, he more as a representative of a segment of our society who still look at you and still look at that and claim, oh, no, they still did it, still call for the death penalty for U5, et cetera, in spite of all of the proof to the contrary and the eventual exoneration. Hello.
Absolutely.
You know, that's the part that kills me. You get exonerated and these asses are still out there going, no, they did it. And so what does that say about where the system still is, that still has vibrancy among us, a large swath of Americans who would look at you and still see, despite evidence, facts, and eventual exoneration, your guilt? Is that a race tinge thing? Is that a cultural thing? What do you see that as when you hear people out there who still say, well, you know, that they just did that because in, you know, societal pressure, but the fact is they're still guilty?
Well, you know, we've often turned off our own ability to participate. And the reason why I'm beginning with that idea is because what we realize is this, that if we were sitting in the courtroom and we were being given the case, and we saw this with the Breonna Taylor case, and this was like perhaps maybe one of the most unfortunate realities of the criminal justice system in America. We're not given the whole story. Like the Central Park Jogger case is an anomaly only in
right.
that there are certain truths that are there that gives us the ability to understand how we could not have done this. I mean, you have, and I'm going to take it all the way back to 1989, right? You have Raymond Santana reading his false confession. And you see this with the documentary, The Central Park Five by Ken Burns. Raymond Santana, as an adult, is reading his false confession, the same false confession that people thought was true in 1989. They said, mm-hmm. wow, the police did a great job. They got them, right? He begins by saying, at approximately 1700 hours, me and a group of my colleagues begin to walk south. Now, you heard this in 1989. Right. But in 2014, when he said that on camera, he looks up and in the most brilliant, magnificent way, he says, what 14-year-old talks like that? I was in the theater. I was in many of the theaters
right.
when the audience saw that moment and you could hear the gasp. How did we believe that? I'm saying, and I don't
me
like
and my colleagues.
Right, right. And I hate using small words because I feel like the small words gives us the incorrect assumption
right.
as to what it is, right? And when I say small words, I'm talking about words like DNA. DNA seems so flimsy. It's like, oh, you know, DNA, right? DNA is what is allowing people who have done sometimes upwards of 40 years to be released from the criminal justice system through the efforts of organizations like the Innocence Project, right? Mm-hmm. And the reason why I said I don't like to use the small words is because if we hear the word deoxyribonucleic acid,
yeah, right.
it causes us to say, what the,
hey, man. what are you talking about?
What's that? That's DNA, right?
That's DNA, baby.
DNA, we all have it, right? And the best thing about DNA is that it is the truth as to whether you did a crime or didn't do a crime. Mm-hmm. In our case, DNA is what freed us. And I'm saying freed us not because we got, you know, released from the prison and the gates opened. I'm not talking about that freedom. I'm talking about after the 13 years of the accusation, Corey Wise in prison bumping into the real perpetrator, the real perpetrator finally telling the truth, they checking his DNA against what they have and finding the match.
Mm-hmm.
Revisiting the narratives that were gotten and saying, ooh, none of these stories match. I never made a written.
And how do you, and how do you, in the face of that truth, all of a sudden now you've got five young men whose DNA is nowhere to be found in the crime scene, yeah. right? It's not on the victim. It's not, you know, on any other piece of evidence that would indicate that the five of you were in that particular part of the park at that particular time
yeah.
to do that crime. And here you have now the DNA of the individual who, yeah, okay, yeah, I did it. How does the system reconcile that truth?
I'm gonna give you, oh my goodness, right? I'm getting goosebumps right now. I'm about to tell you something that we saw in 1989. We saw video image of Kevin Richardson in Central Park. We saw this. I mean, I'm saying, like, if you go back and look at this stuff, you say to yourself, wait, when was this taken?
Right. Right.
Kevin and Corey, I want to remind the audience, Corey was not a suspect. Kevin and Corey were taken back to Central Park. They were taken there on April 20th. And when they were taken there, Corey, who was not a suspect, who had gym sneakers on, whatever he had on, same way that we young people wear their sneakers today, he just slid them on, right? They don't even, like, it, you look like a square, a cornball. You look like you're not,
right.
If you tie your sneakers up, right? He had his sneakers slid on. The officer, now check this out. One of the officers said, hey man, your sneakers untied. Now in a free world, what do people say? Hey man, this, I like wearing my shoes like this. It's part of my style. But if you're in trouble, you don't say nothing other than yes, sir. In this case, Corey, he bent down to tie his sneakers. Another officer, they're at the scene of the crime. And I need you to understand this. Another officer walks up to Corey and tries to bump him so that he could fall into the scene of the crime.
Wow.
These are things that we don't know. I'm saying if the public knew, then the public wouldn't say to themselves, oh, they got let go because of some type of technicality.
Right.
Right. Even Donald Trump, we don't want to talk about him. Right. But I remember when we won our lawsuit, he said, now they're going to be rich rapists.
Yeah.
It's this idea. And it always has been this idea that the system is infallible, that the system, if it got it wrong, this is not the norm. This is an anomaly. No, this is the norm. Hundreds of people through the work of the Innocence Project have been freed through deoxyribonucleic acid, right? The Equijustice Initiative, you see the work that they're doing. All of the Innocence Networks around the country are doing tremendous work trying to free people. And I'm just saying that the criminal justice system should work. But we see that it's not working.
Right.
Or is it?
Or is it?
And I say, or is it, because it used to be that we would say the system is broken and we have to show them why. We have to talk to the heartstrings of America. But now we realize that the system is not broken. It's operating exactly as it was imagined in the minds of the people who created it.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, black and brown bodies can be relegated. Not all, not just black and brown bodies, but the majority of the makeup of this system, black and brown bodies can be relegated to the new cotton fields of America. We see this work through the works of a Michelle Alexander, right?
Mm-hmm.
We see this work through the works of a doctor. I gotta say doctor now, Ava DuVernay, right? She created the film 13th.
Right.
And we see this stuff and we say to ourselves, this can't be right. It's because we personally haven't been run over. But I remember there was a song that said, me today, you tomorrow.
That's it.
Right. And what we have to do is we have to figure out how do we transform? I was going to say, how do we fix? How do we transform this system so that the system operates in the new idea of the kaleidoscope of the human family who are now the people? And so we, the people, we deserve better.
Yeah, and you bring that out. You and Kevin and Raymond wrote a piece back in January of this year in the New York Times. We are the Exonerated Five. What happened to us isn't past; it's present. And in it, you note quote, but what people may not realize is that what happened to us isn't just the past; it's the present. The methods that the police use to coerce us, five terrified young boys, into falsely confessing are still commonly used today. And it's interesting that we're now in May of this year in the state of Illinois. The Associated Press is reporting the Illinois legislature has approved a bill banning police deception to young suspects. They note Illinois became the first state to pass a bill that will ban police from lying to young people during interrogations, a practice that adds significantly to the risk of false confessions and wrongful convictions. It is expected to be signed into law by the governor in the next few weeks. Here's the interesting part. Though few Americans realize it, police regularly deceive suspects during questioning to try to secure confessions from saying DNA, place them at the scene of a crime to claiming eyewitnesses identify them as being the perpetrator. Detectives also lie about consequences of confessing, saying, for instance, that admitting responsibility is a quick ticket home. Your experience now then is the predicate for the change, the transformation in this system that you're talking about. How do you, I don't want to say how do you feel about that, but what are your thoughts about that? Particularly since, you know, as you noted in your piece, you kind of say, you need to understand this is how we're trapping young, particularly young kids of color in this system in the first instance. You're just sort of grabbing them up off the street and because they fit a general description. And it's downhill from there. How do you see the system transforming and changing? Is it through efforts like we see in Illinois, where you recognize we just can't hook kids up like this anymore? We just can't think that we can put them in the box and start telling them all this stuff, a lot of which, if you step back from it, conflicts with itself. Where do you see these reforms going and how does that play out, particularly given where we see legislatures, despite what we, you know, just saw or heard in Illinois, still are taking steps that make it harder to change the system?
You know, so when I look at the system, in my experience, I would say that we have to work inside.
Mm-hmm.
We have to become the spooks who sat by the door. And I'm using that terminology in particular because of the great work of Sam Greenlee in that book and what it meant. But then because of what happened with George Floyd and our ancestors' wildest dreams poured out into the streets and erupted. And the language that was being used was abolition, was defund. And I realized that although we have to work from the inside out, a lot of the people on the inside have lost the ability to keep their eyes on the prize. And so we've been lured away. We've agreed to be participants because we have been guaranteed in many ways through word and maybe not in reality that we will be safe. I'm saying that we have to keep the pressure on.
Mm-hmm.
The work has to happen on the outside and it has to happen on the inside. And on the outside, people have to continue to march and raise their voice in the same way that Dr. Maya Angelou said when she mm-hmm. taught us how to be alchemists. She said, use that anger. You dance it. You march it. You vote it. You do everything about it. You talk it. Never stop talking it, she said. And then on the inside, we have to do better. We cannot look at the mirror of our experience and say that we are okay. We have to take our experience and figure out how do we create legacy? Because everything is now about legacy, right? Mm-hmm. The legacy that the officers used in terms of their tactics with regards to the Central Park Five, as we were known, left a very, very bad taste in the mouth of not only the system, but also the families that those individuals came from. And I'm just saying that the Reed Institute, which I believe is in Chicago, which utilizes these particular, like I think it's like a certain number of tactics. If you use these tactics, you will guarantee success
mm-hmm.
of being able to take a person and make them confess, right? It's the same thing that we saw when people see, and this is the funny thing about it. People say to themselves, man, I would never confess to a crime I didn't commit. I want to use a film a film from a great actor named Denzel Washington, right? Mm-hmm. And in this particular film, the title of the film is called Safe House.
Mm-hmm.
He gets caught. I think 15 minutes into the film, he gets caught. He gets strapped to a chair, and they're telling him, listen, give us the information. He says, no, I'm not giving y'all nothing. And they look at each other and they say, shucks, well, I guess we got to go and do the things that we aren't supposed to do. And they nod at each other and they grab the tools of war. And in that war kit is the, I forget the actual name of it, but it's waterboarding.
Mm-hmm.
That's the word I'm thinking about. They're about to waterboard him. They lean him back, put the cloth over his mouth. And this is the part that I didn't know what he was saying at first. He says, that looked like, and I'm making this the numbers up, but he said the same thing. That looks like 300 count. You need at least 5,000 count. And I'm like, what is he talking about? Right?
Right.
This is before we won the lawsuit, so I had no idea that there was different threat counts in cloth.
Right.
But he's saying, that looks like 300 count. You need at least 5,000 count. And he said, well, so-and-so broke after X amount of time. He said, well, yeah, but that don't look like it's going to break me. And sure enough, what happens? He is waterboarded. He's brought back up and then he spits the water out almost like he's mocking them and says, how long was that? Essentially, what he was saying was that if the tactics are correct, if you utilize the same methodology that you use to break this other individual, I too will break. Mm-hmm. But if you do not use the tactics and the system knows the tactics, I mean, that's why they know that there's other interrogative processes differing from the Reed technique. Why is it that they use the Reed technique in these cases? It's because it is a guarantee, it's a guarantor of success that they will cause a person to confess to a crime that they have not committed. And I'm saying that because are we seeing a transformation happening? We are. But the system has always played the tango with us. We need to make sure that we keep our eyes on the prize. We need to make sure that we participate in our freedom, justice, and equality, and we need to lean in a little bit more. We cannot then turn a blind eye and say they're going to take care of it. That's the same thing that we've always done with presidencies.
Right.
That's the same thing that we've always done with any government office that we've elected people into. Right. But today is a different day. We've been almost guaranteed that if we remind our public figures, hey, listen, we voted you into office under these guidelines. You said you were going to give us this. We can remind them.
Right.
We can keep, you know, the pressure on, because what's going to happen on the other side is that the system is going to say, now you're in, forget them. This is why in the Black and Brown community, we use and create terminology like politrics.
Right.
Because they say left wing, right wing, same bird.
Same bird, baby.
It's the same system. So the free thinking people are saying to themselves, how do we get a better system?
Right.
Why is it that we only have two options? What is?
I've been saying that for years, baby. Right?
Yeah. And all I'm saying is that we have the opportunity today, because of what we do, to break all kinds of generational curses.
Right.
We can wrap in our baton of DNA, our DNA that is being passed to the next generations to come, everything great. We can tell them and teach them and show them through our example how to do this.
Right? So I'd asked you earlier about hope. As we begin to end our conversation, which I regret that I do have to end it because you've got stuff to do, brother. I know. I want to ask you about forgiveness.
Yeah.
Have you been able to forgive not the system, that because that's an inanimate object, but the individuals who came after you, vilified you, stripped down your personhood. How has forgiveness been for you in this process? And is that part of this memoir for you? That is that process of forgiveness?
Yeah, I got to tell you, you know, I want to say this first, that we are at war. The war that we are fighting is not about color, mm-hmm. although it appears that way in America. But if we do that 30,000 mm-hmm. view of the world, we realize that in other places in the world, oppression looks like people who look like each other oppressing each other.
Right.
What we're fighting is spiritual wickedness in high and low places. That is where we are fighting at, right? That's the crux of the matter. When we think about the people who harmed us, people like Donald Trump, who 2 weeks after we were accused, took out a full page ad that began with the words, bring back the death penalty, bring mm-hmm. back our police. People like Pat Buchanan, who writes in the papers, well, let's just take the eldest one, Corey Wise, and hang him from a tree in Central Park, and saying that we should do this by June 1st. I'm saying that those individuals, regardless of whether it's a part of their makeup or not, we are the ones who are harmed by it even more, by continuing to pull into our now the ball and chain seeking forgiveness that's wrapped around our legs, mm-hmm. that's pulling us back from us being able to truly be great, right? And I'm saying that what I found out, and I had to understand this is not something that just poof happened to me. I found out that forgiveness is not for the person, mm-hmm. but it is for you. It is for you to surgically remove that ball and chain holding you back mm-hmm. because of the wanting. We live in a world of abundance, not a world of lack. And in the abundance of everything, as I look at things from a different angle, I can see that God is creating this diamond, right? I'm not necessarily special in that regard. We are special. And if we choose to attach ourselves to spiritual wickedness, then we never get an opportunity to rise out of the gravitational pull of everything negative. But as soon as we allow ourselves to remove ourselves from the wanting of a sorry that will never come, we give our chance, the we give ourselves the opportunity, the greatest opportunity, to be exactly what we are supposed to be. And we find our purpose through that process. And so I've had to learn to forgive those individuals. Mm-hmm. And so if somebody said to me, do you forgive Donald Trump? Right? Mm-hmm. Well, you have to take it into context, right? I can't say yes. You have to take the whole of what thing, I'm saying, right? Into That's context. Right. Because ask yourself this. And I'm not saying you. I'm just talking about people, right? Ask yourself this. Is Donald Trump thinking about Yusuf Salaam? Like me particular? Absolutely not. Did he think about me particular in the context of his presidency?
In fact, I would almost bet that if you could have randomly picked any other five young black kids at that time back in 1989 and put them in front of Donald Trump, and he wouldn't have been able to identify them as not being the Central Park Five.
Absolutely. Right. And so I'm saying that we have the opportunity to become our own heroes. We are the liberators that we seek, right? We have this great question, who's going to help us? We are going to help ourselves. How are we going to help ourselves? Through sacred memory, remembering that we were born on purpose and with a purpose. We can be better and not bitter by everything that comes our way, depending on what happens inside of us as our response. Because if we respond in a powerful way, then all of the negativity that happens to us, the things that hit us in life and make us fall down, right? We could be slammed in the head with a 2x4, but life is trying to teach us, if we look at it from a different angle, mm-hmm. to develop peripheral vision. It's not about if you fall, like my good friend Les Brown says, but when you fall. He said, try to land on your back, because if you can look up, you can get up. But what happens when you land on your face? Turn over and lay on your back for a moment. Get yourself together.
Well, and when you land on your face like that, which is probably one of the more difficult moments, mm-hmm. You push up. Yeah. Is what you do. That's what you do. And I've been in that room. I've landed on my face, and you've got to push up. And I think it's the strength of Black people is that since 1619, we've always been pushing up and pushing up against a system that wants us splayed out on our face, you know, because again, on your back, you know, you're getting up that way, right? But when they've got you down, face down, it's like that moment you referred to it earlier when they say kiss the ground, right? Mm. It is the ultimate vulnerable position. You can't see. You can't process because your face is in the concrete. It's in the dirt. Yeah. But in that moment, you find that inner strength to push up. And that's for me, your story, man. You've pushed up. You've pushed back. You have stood up. And you stand among giants who, you know, represent not just what a system can do to a person, but ultimately how that person can change the system.
Absolutely.
And so I found this conversation, as I hope our audience has, just enlightening and purposeful, and gives a lot of meaning to a very, very dark chapter. And I think for you, better, not bitter, is a path that a lot of us need to get on. And that's why you are helping us live that purposeful life, you know, to try to find, the tools and the strength and need to push back against and to push up from a system that still very much wants to keep us in those chains. And Yusuf Salam, man, you do it. You're bringing it. And I appreciate you taking time to bring your advocacy to this conversation.
Man, my pleasure. My pleasure. It is that which is the alchemy that we can all become.
Amen. Amen. The book is Better, Not Bitter, Living on Purpose in the Pursuit of Racial Justice. The author, the activist. There's so many other words I could use to describe this brother. I'm just sitting here going, the inspirational speaker, all of it. I mean, I've just been caught up by your conversation. Yusuf Salam, thank you for coming to the podcast and spending some time with us and taking us through your journey and giving us a moment in your shoes, which a lot of people, you know, don't get to do, to really walk it with someone in their shoes for a moment to understand what that journey's been like. And to realize, man, you know, hey, there are moments where our journeys link up, they overlap, you know, and I thank you for helping us do that. So, real pleasure. Folks, get out, get the book, get it on Amazon, wherever you get your books from. Check it out. Yep, there it is. There Better, it is. Not Bitter. Is there a website or anything that they can, folks can sort of track you and follow you on and et cetera?
Yeah, absolutely. So my personal website is Yusuf Speaks. That's YusufSpeaks.com. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm on Instagram. That's dr.yusufsalam. I'm on Twitter as Dr. That's dr_yusufsalam. And I'm on Facebook as Dr. Yusuf Salam, on my public page and on my private page, Yusuf Abdus Salam. Definitely on all social media platforms, LinkedIn, I'm there. I have a Snapchat, don't know how to use it. I got 10 children, but my children are trying to keep me hip and cool. You know, the oldest is 25, the youngest is 5, you know, 7 girls, 3 boys. But yeah, follow us out there, you know, and when you Google the books or Google my name, you'll probably find the books Punching the Air, you know, which is written by not only myself, but also E.B. Zaboy. Last year we published it. And this is the new favorite of Better, Not Bitter, Living on Purpose in the Pursuit of Racial Justice. It is important And I think that it gives us opportunities to see that there's light over there.
Yeah.
And more importantly, that we also have light and we can turn our lights up.
Well, that, you know, you're funny you should say that, because I always, you know, like to quote, you know, Reagan's quote of sort of the biblical passage about the shining city on the hill. Mm-hmm. And Reagan just kind of left it at that. You know, that was a great speech, and, you know, and it's a great reference to America being that beacon with the Lady Liberty in the harbor with that great light. Give us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses longing to be free. But what I emphasize, and I'm so glad to hear you just do that, is the light in that city is us.
Yeah.
And when that light dims, it's because we have turned it down. We have stopped being that light. And as the times we're going through right now lends itself to a lot of folks out there trying to turn the lights out, not just dim them. Yeah. And that's why Better Not Bitter, Yusuf Salam, the story of the boys and the men who are the Central Park Five, needs to be told, and the light shine from that story. So I appreciate that, because that reference, because it does speak a lot about that ideal of America being a beacon. Yes. And you're as much a part of that beacon, more so in many respects, than a lot of other folks out there right now. And so I thank you and applaud you for that. And I wish you Godspeed and all the best, and be well and successful, and continue to be that inspiration.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And you as well.
Well, I'm just a brother in the neighborhood, so we try to make it work. All right, folks, that does it for our conversation this time. I appreciate you taking a moment to stop in and be a part of what I think is just a powerful story, and of hope and forgiveness, opportunity and pride, you know, that we should all have in folks like Yusuf Salam. You know where to find us on Twitter and certainly at Michael Steele. Check me out there. And don't forget to do that download thing. You know, I love it when you download. It just makes me feel all yummy inside. So go to Apple, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Spotify. Do the download thing. Share this particular episode, folks, with folks with your friends and family, because I think there's a lot that they'll get from it. So until next time, be safe, be well, get the vaccine. Don't be stupid out there. Stay healthy, and we'll meet up again. Take care.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.